Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hi, and welcome to our bonus episode of my interview with Jill Mansell, the author of Millie's Fling. If you haven't listened to my chat with Ella Risbridger about the book, maybe go back and listen now for the full experience. Here's my full conversation with Jill, in which we discuss snobbery, twiglets, and why bad things happen to good people.
You've written, like, so many books, and I think Millie's Fling is probably somewhere in the middle, right? Like,
it's towards the beginning, I think.
Oh, is it? Okay.
It's probably my 11th. I'm just looking at the names. Yeah, not sure.
I can't believe that your 11th book is somewhere near the beginning.
I know. It's bizarre, isn't it? And somebody was saying, what was it, not so long ago, she said, oh, I started reading your books when I was sort of a teenager at school, and now I'm a grandma. And I just thought, oh, I feel 5,000 years old.
Well, one of the things we were actually talking about, because Ella, I have to confess, Millie's Fling is the first one of your books that I've read, but Ella's been reading your books since she was 8 years old. And and she says everything she knows about wine, food, cooking, everything is based on what the women in Jill Mansell books were buying. So the only reason that she buys Montepulciano every time she goes to Sainsbury's is because of your books.
Yes. Oh, I think she told me that a couple of years back. That's so funny. And Frascati as well. I used to really love Frascati as well. And loads of people wrote to me and said, oh, we always buy Frascati because of you.
I love it's that. Like the,
it's like Jilly Cooper with her perfume. What was that perfume that Jilly Cooper always used to write about? Fracas?
No, I love that. I've actually realized while doing this podcast that a lot of chick lit writers, they tend to have their own area of food and snacking, because snacking and food is very important in most chick lit books.
Yeah.
And Marion Keyes tends to be more about chocolate, but you're more about crisps.
Yes. Yes, I eat very little chocolate, actually.
I'd love to know a bit about, I mean, I'm going way off the mark here, but I'd love to know about at what point food became such a big part of your books?
I suppose the food thing is because I'm sitting here on my sofa writing all day, I'm just mainly thinking, what can I eat next? All the time. I think Nigella once said, you know, she wakes up in the morning and she thinks, what can I eat next? And as soon as she's had that, she thinks, right, what next? You know, what's the next meal I can have? And I think I'm a bit like that. I don't understand people who aren't like that.
I know. I it's kind of like, you know how people say, I don't trust a skinny chef. I don't trust a skinny author.
Yeah, so I used to be skinny. Well, no, the reason I don't have chocolate very much is I had this big operation when I was 21. My stomach was removed.
Oh,
and,
God.
I know. So chocolate is, I love it to bits, but I can only have a very small amount of chocolate after I've eaten a big meal. So it's all a bit complicated, but crisps are great and they're very easy for me to eat.
I bet you, like, there's a whole bit in Millie's Fling where the two girls, Hester and Millie, are just talking about twiglets versus chipsticks, and I can just imagine you with the festive tub of twiglets just get on deadline, just getting it done, you know.
Oh no, twiglets every time. Oh, I don't even like chipsticks.
Well, that's very evident from the prose.
Oh, is it?
So I kind of started it way in the middle there, just because we started talking about food. But I'd love to. I realize that you've written so many books, and Millie's Fling, it must feel like a long time ago. But I'd love to know what your kind of memories are of writing the book. Like what period of time it was, what was going on. Like, tell me a bit about that.
Okay, well, I mean, there's a couple. People always ask where the ideas come from, and I can remember very clearly the ideas for this one. Our children were very small. We were on holiday in a fairly grim caravan park in Cornwall, and still quite poor then, I think. and somebody had left a copy of the News of the World on a bench or something. So I picked it up, and there was a piece in there about a woman who'd met the love of her life because he dropped his wallet, and she'd gone through the wallet and thought, oh, I know quite a lot about him. So she phoned him up as a joke and pretended that she knew him. So I stole that idea for the book.
Yeah.
And but obviously gave it the twist that she's talking jokingly about his lovely wife or girlfriend, and then it turns out that, you know, he's the tragic widower. So that was one of the starting off ideas. And the other one was poor Gilly Cooper. Do you know the journalist and author Craig Brown?
I don't.
No, I think he used to write for the Times or the Telegraph. Anyway, he gave her, one of her books, the most awful review. And it was really, really terrible, criticising her and her books, everything about her. It was a famously awful review. So then I sort of stole that idea for poor Orla and had her fall in love with the guy at the end, which Gilly Cooper didn't do that.
But, you know, I wouldn't call Gilly Cooper incapable of doing that, you know? I have so much I want to ask about Orla. I think she was my favourite part of the book, and I imagine most writers probably say that to you.
She was brilliant, wasn't she? Do you know what I think? I'm turning into her. Because
really?
When I wrote the book, I wasn't a bit like her. And I think since then, I have sort of become more like her. Clothes-wise, I mean, does she wear sort of long, flowy clothes?
She does lots of purples, lots of like stuff that you think I'd find in Monsoon. You know, that shop?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's me now. But it never used to be me.
That's fascinating. So when you were writing Orla, what was your like perception of her then?
Gosh. She was like an archetypal, oh, what's the word? I can't even think of the word. But a real sort of character of a successful female novelist. Mm. And the other thing was that I think I described the way she planned out her books was sticking all these details up around her walls and things. And I never did anything like that. And since then, or years afterwards, I started making my timelines and sticking millions of post-it notes onto great swathes of paper. So I when I wrote that, it was like the last thing I would ever do to plan out a book.
That's so funny. That's like
now I do it.
It's a bit when you know when you you're feeling a bit depressed, so you write a to-do list of things that you've already done that day so you can cross them off and have the satisfaction.
Brush teeth. Put socks on.
I don't know if Ella's already told you this, but that is how she has planned her books, based on Orla Hart's method, because she read that as a teenager and said, oh, that must be how you do it. That must be how Jill's doing it. Because
I think she did tell me that, yes. See, now I can't even remember the things that Ella said to me. But yes, I think she did say that. And I feel as if I've sort of belatedly grown into those methods, but I honestly at the time it was nothing like the way that I wrote.
But all of Orla's segments in the book, when she's not like, you know, being the sort of director of the plot for Millie, as it were, and when she's not sort of doing her kind of setting her up on dates and stuff, I see her very much as not a cipher for you, because you're clearly very different and you write very different books to her, and she is much more of a Jackie Collins, Gilly Cooper type of novelist, whereas you aren't. But what I felt like it was you kind of looking to the reader and being like, these books, like books that are chick lit, books that are for women, that people sneer at and tell you that they're trash or that they're easy or that they're formulaic, they are difficult to write, they are difficult to plan, and, you know, think twice before you second guess this genre.
Absolutely. And I'm told those things not daily, but nearly daily, because people just do sneer at the kind of books and the reviews. Well, on Amazon, I suppose the people who write some of the reviews on Amazon, I don't think they ever think that the authors look at them. Mm-hmm. I look at all my reviews. And what drives me more nuts than anything is when they say, oh, within the first couple of chapters, I'd worked out who was going to end up with who at the end. And I just think,
well, congratulations.
You know, do you really think that that wasn't supposed to be obvious? So, yes, people tell me, oh, those kind of books, you write those, do you? And I don't let it really bother me anymore because I've had it for so long. Obviously, it bothers me a tiny bit.
That is, you know, one of the reasons that I'm doing this podcast and why I've called it sentimental garbage, because my first book came out this year and I heard it being described. I saw it in an Amazon review being described as something like that, or using kind of pejorative like that, a kind of a stand in for like, oh, chick lit is all garbage, it's all sentimental, whatever. And I just feel like it's kind of time to reclaim that, especially as I feel people now, they're kind of going towards that more domestic noir, Gillian Flynn. Yeah. Like, that seems to be the direction things are going in. It's like, oh, everyone's a horrible person and everyone's backstabbing each other and yeah. Everyone's dead at the end, you know?
Absolutely, yes. And I know an awful lot of people are embarrassed to be seen reading my books in public. That's fine. It just means I sell more on Kindle.
And, like, at what point did that stop pissing you off? Is it when you just sold enough copies that you were like, you know what, I'm laughing my way to the bank?
Kind of, I think so, yes. I mean, obviously, to begin with, there was no Amazon,
yeah,
of course. So I didn't see anything like that. And I didn't tend to get letters from people saying bad things about my books. You'd get fan mail back then, and it was always nice. So it wasn't until Amazon came along and we were able to sort of see other people saying things, although I was aware, obviously, at the time that other people said, oh, you write, what kind of books do you write? Oh, really? Oh, don't you ever fancy writing, you know, a real book?
Oh, God.
No, it's the extent to which I'm bothered by it has slid down over the years. But
and did you ever have a problem with the term chick lit? I think some authors do.
The only reason I don't love it is because It's a, you know, I know that it's a handy thing for other people to use to describe a certain genre of book. But with my books, it's not just about girls in their 20s who work in an office and they get drunk on a Friday night and buy nice clothes in Topshop or wherever. Mm-hmm. Because I have the old characters and the younger characters and the middle-aged characters. And, you know, I just sort of have a lot of issues in the books and serious segments. So it is, like you say, it's pejorative. It's just not, it's not a true description of the books. Not just my books, most chick lit writers, they deal with other serious issues as well.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I think Ella actually said this in the main episode, but she said, like, everybody tells you that chick lit is simple or formulaic, but actually none of the books I've read for this series or have read in the past, like, could I really describe as simple beyond the sort of sense of like, oh yes, I can see who the romantic lead is from the beginning. Of course I can. Of course they're going to end up together. But actually all the plot that happens, for example, in Millie's Fling, it's obviously a book that centres on Millie, but it's a book about a community of people sort of living their lives and we sort of drop in on all of them. And it's, you know, you could compare it to Middlemarch if you wanted to, do you know? It's like, you really get a sense. I've never been to Newquay and I feel like I know it like the back of my hand now, you know?
I think it's changed a lot. I have been to Newquay, but I don't know if I if I'd been there before I wrote it.
But I just think that, like, I got such a strong sense of even the economy of the town. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Like,
and I think that's another thing I really, really loved about your books as well, because you often get in chick lit and in commercial women's fiction in general, is that, like, either the characters have very aspirational jobs or lives, or they're desperately aiming to be actresses or journalists or whatever. But actually, what I loved about this was that, you know, Millie works in a travel agent and she liked working in apart from her crappy bosses, obviously, but she really enjoyed her small job, and she really enjoyed, and like Hester really enjoys like working at the jewelry stand. And it's only when Orla comes in and says to her, like, oh, I want to write about people with kind of normal jobs and cheap shoes. You know, that's the only minute where Millie was even challenged to think about her life as anything less than ideal. And I love that.
Yes. Well, I'm sort of two reasons I do that. I think I like for the characters to do jobs that appeal to a lot of readers. And a lot of readers don't want to read about people with very, very aspirational careers. And also that involves more research. That it's very difficult. It's very difficult to get the research right if a job is something that isn't widely known about. And because I worked in clinical neurophysiology, you know, I've read lots of books in the past where clinical neurophysiology is a part of it. And it's just cringy seeing the mistakes that are made by people who, you know, they've done a lot of research and think they've got it right, but they haven't.
I didn't know about this previous career. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? That's really interesting.
Oh, yes. I worked as clinical neurophysiology technician.
I don't really know what that means. What is it? I'm sorry. That probably sounds really ignorant, but I don't.
Well, you know, ECGs measure the electricity in the heart.
Yeah.
An EEG measures the electricity in the brain. It's electroencephalography. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the aspects of the work. It's neurophysiology. Anybody with anything to do with the brain, people either used to come to us if they were able to, or we would travel around to different hospitals and intensive care units, cardiac care units, baby units in the hospitals in this area, and we'd carry out the tests to see what was wrong with their brains. Wow.
And so how long did you do this before you were a full-time novelist?
18 years.
And then when did you become Jill Mansell women's fiction novelist?
So I was there for 18 years. I mean, I went there from 16. I got the job when I was 16. I'd started A-levels. My mum thought I wasn't doing as much work as I should do for my A-levels. So she sort of found me this job in the local paper. It said, do you want to be an electroencephalographic technician in the field of clinical neurophysiology? So I went for it and I got the job, and I trained there doing the job. And I was there for 18 years. I think I wrote two books or possibly three books while I was there. And then I got pregnant with my daughter. So I gave up work so that I could write books and have a quiet little baby at home sleeping all day long, which didn't happen. So yes, that's the way it worked, and luckily for me it did work out, because it's very difficult working in the hospital when you need childcare, because it's when it's a job like that, there's a certain amount of work that needs doing plus the emergency calls that come in each day. So it just seemed easier to give up.
Well,
and a writer then.
Yeah, and we're all very glad for it, to be honest.
it wasn't all smooth sailing.
It sounds very smooth sailing.
Well, no, but my sales dropped year on year for the first six books, and then I was dropped by Transworld. Oh. I was with Transworld to begin with. They tried their best. They were lovely. I loved them, but the books just didn't take off. And I was dropped, and then I was rejected by a few other publishers, and then Headline took me on. They hauled me out of the gutter.
Oh my goodness! So had you kind of almost like hung up your boots a bit?
Nearly. I was afraid that it was about to happen. Yes, and I think it was, you know, that I don't know, you're so young, that's the trouble. The style of book covers, say, 20 years ago, with all the legs on the covers.
Yes,
girls
yes.
with long legs. So I think Headline, they sort of did that right from the beginning, and with Perfect Timing was my first book with them. And the covers seemed to take off, and the books sold more after that.
That's so funny, because in the main episode, Ella talked about those leg and chew covers, yeah. and those are the covers that she had. And she has a really, really strong fondness for those ones. while we're on the sort of the general book industry, I would love to talk to you a bit, and I'm sure you don't remember much about him because you wrote him so long ago, but Christy Carson, I am obsessed with.
Oh, are you? Well, he's the baddie man, isn't he?
I know, but the thing is that I don't know, maybe you were aiming some kind of criticism at something, but my experience as a Irish novelist who is writing books that are primarily read by English people is that I always get the sense that people want me to be a kind of an Irish novelist who writes beautifully simplistic things about living in the countryside and, you know, priests molesting people and all very like, you know, jolly but true but barren but sorrowful, but, you know, that specific kind of Irish writer that the English press loves.
Uh-huh.
And Christy Carson is the most brilliant parody of that entire kind of industry that I have ever read. And
oh, that's fantastic. I remember a thing about it.
I really urge you to go back over it, because the way Orla sort of talks, she's reading it and she's like, yeah, it's good, I suppose, in that Irish way. And she kind of describes that sort of like typically Irish novel, and I was like, oh, this is such a good send-up of this entire genre, and no other author would be brave enough to take the piss out of this, you know.
Oh no, I wish I could remember it. I can't bear to reread my books.
You never do to.
No, well, I sort of have to, because my American publisher is publishing them for the first time in the States. And they're going back over the really oldest ones. Fast Friends is my very first book, it's coming out in January in the States.
Oh my goodness.
And oh my goodness, some of it is so dated. I mean, it seems so dated to me, but so many people write to tell me that that's their favorite book of mine.
I think Ella talked to me about this. It was the one where the friends meet up from school and one of them is having an affair with the other one's husband. Yes. I think that's her favourite as well. But she wanted to do Millie's Fling because she knew I'd love Christy Carson.
Yes, it's so strange. So I do have to sort of slightly skim through and check and make everything American that needs to be American. But I really don't enjoy reading my own books. I suppose because it's like watching yourself on TV. You just think, oh, why did I look like that? Why did I say that? You know, I don't like not being able to go back and correct it.
Well, yeah, my one only came out in June, and I already am totally embarrassed by it. And I'm still in that kind of thing where I'm doing readings at bookshops and stuff. And every time I'm like, oh, God, what a horrible book, you know?
I can't even bear to do readings. I just say, oh, no, let's not do that. That's awful.
Let's don't and say we did. So I would be really interested to know, because I know that your books these days, they tend to focus on somewhat more serious subject matter, in that there tends to be like a lot of long-term illness in them and that kind of thing. And I was wondering, like, if your perspective has changed a bit as a writer.
I think over years, well, I think I don't know, is it always long-term illness? Sometimes it is. It's a lot to do with trying to think of something new and interesting to form a basis for a book. Obviously, I'm always interested in that kind of thing. And obviously, working in the hospital for 18 years, it was a neurological rehabilitation hospital. So I've always known a lot about that kind of thing. And I'm interested in it. I'm very interested in how people deal with illness. We used to have a very unscientific thing that we'd call the patient in from the waiting room for their very first test that they're having. And we've seen their symptoms, and it could be something or it could be nothing. And we always seemed that the nicer the person, the more likely it was to be something awful.
Oh my God.
And it really, we all said that. Oh, she's a really nice person. Oh dear, that's bad news. And it just always does seem to be that way. It's not always, obviously, but wow. But I am interested in how people deal with illness and awful things happening in their lives.
God, if I ever have any kind of a scare, I'm just going to be horrible to everyone at the hospital.
Yes, me too.
Just awful. Jill, I meant to have you on the phone for 20 minutes and I've had you on for half an hour. Thank you so much for giving me the time with this, and I really can't wait until the whole thing is out and you can hear us praising your book so much.
I can't wait to hear it. It sounds as if it's going to be fantastic, and it's long overdue, isn't it? It's so lovely to have, you know, somebody talking nicely about our genre of books.
Yeah, that's the idea. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Lovely to talk to you.
Thanks to Jill for talking to me, and thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of Sentimental Garbage, where I chat to Helen O'Hara about Career Girls by Louise Mensch. This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at zarolineodonoghue@gmail.com. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast, produced by Hannah Varrell.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.